Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's edition of the podcast. Today's guest, Stephen McDonald of Red Cross. Get to that in a minute. First, just a couple upcoming notifications. Paul Carrack was in the band Squeeze, saying the 1973 giant hit How Long Has This Been Going On. He'll be our guest May 16th. Sonny Charles of the Checkmates will be our guest May 30th. He had a long career in Las Vegas. I think he's still singing in Las Vegas. I saw them there 20 years ago. They also had a Phil Spector-produced album and a sort of a hit off of that, Black Pearl. So looking forward to that May 30th. Of course, WFMU.org/Michael, the place to check for what's coming up on this program. Also wanted to welcome Spotify listeners. I heard from somebody who just discovered the show on Spotify, and they tell me that there's a huge archive of the show on Spotify. I know that some providers they delete the episodes after a couple weeks, so it's nice to hear that Spotify's keeping lots of episodes around. So hello to new Spotify listeners and old listeners. You might check out Spotify as a platform to hear the podcast. Steve McDonald of Red Cross, fascinating band. It's good to talk to somebody of this generation. I'm so used to talking to guys a little older than this, so fascinating. Just a super interesting band, a super interesting attitude, that sort of Southern California punk thing coming from the suburbs of Los Angeles. This is super interesting and not that explored by me, part of the link in the chain of music history. So I was curious. I've always liked Red Cross, always enjoyed their records and their live work. So curious how those guys, if you've ever seen them, they just have a real interesting look about them. And hopefully I get a little bit into that, figuring out why they do what they do. Here is Steve McDonald of Red Cross. All right, there is definitely Red Cross. And on the telephone, Stephen McDonald joins us. Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am feeling, semi-lucky and semi-scrambled brain, but generally pretty good. How about you?
Yeah. That seems like a fair assessment for all of us.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on in the Red Cross world. It's sort of the 40th anniversary of your first release, which is just getting the re-release treatment with bonus tracks and stuff. Comes out June 26th on Merge. And there's some other re-releases coming out and huge tours possibly planned. You never know. And I don't know. It's just, and maybe a documentary I see being made about you. So there's sort of a lot, even there's nothing going on, there's actually sort of a lot going on. So on the first EP, the one that's coming out, there's a song called I Hate My School. Did you guys hate school growing up?
Well, definitely at the time, because we were still in school at the time we wrote that song, and we both were firmly haters of school at that moment. But I think for me, I actually didn't mind grammar school, but the second I got into punk rock, and that was coincidentally intersecting with the moment that I started junior high, which is the most heinous time for the human species, I think. And so, it was a bit of a double whammy to be like a social pariah in junior high. So, it was good. So it was good that I had that outlet to co-write and perform such a number.
Yeah. So you guys grew up in Hawthorne, California. I lived in LA for a while, but Hawthorne is kind of like a mystery to me. I know it's kind of a little south of LA. It's near the airport. It's not quite right on the beach like some cool places, but is it just suburbia? Is that all it is?
Well, sure. I mean, I think it was like a fantasy suburbia in the 40s and 50s when the Beach Boys were growing up there. By the 70s, it was a bit grittier. And, there was lots of like prostitution on the streets, and just because we were near the airport also, but it was just that 70s era. And then also another thing that really kind of characterized the time that we were living there was that they were building new freeways, and the city was buying up tons of these tract houses and then vacating them, but then the city would change the plan of where the freeway was going to go. And then, so basically they were turning like entire neighborhoods into ghost towns, but then not doing anything with the houses. So It was interesting, you know. It was kind of like that movie Suburbia, I guess. That's funny you're asking if it was like Suburbia, like just suburban sprawl, like Pleasant Valley Sunday, I guess. But it was a little bit more like that movie. Not that there were like punkers squatting in our neighborhood. It was more like there was hookers squatting in these houses. And well, you know, and like, it was in the process. Then like you know that the sex working was all going on one street, Imperial Highway. That it's one of the main arteries that went to LAX before the freeway existed, and we just happened to live the first residential street behind Imperial Highway. So we were very, Jeff and I were very tuned into that energy that was going on around us.
So what did your folks do? What was, were, you know, happy childhood? What were they doing?
Well, my father's a precision welder down here in, well, I don't live in the South Bay anymore. Hawthorne's part of an area called the South Bay of Los Angeles. And, most of that area, most of the industry is like aerospace. It's a lot of space stuff and military stuff, or also airplane building, like commercial jets and Boeing and stuff like that. So my father has just had his own small business, which he still does at 81. He just welds parts, you know, stuff that gets subcontracted out to smaller businesses from bigger corporations like Northrop and Garrett.
Gotcha.
Things like that.
So judging, you know, just listening to Red Cross, if I had to imagine your childhood, I would imagine you watching TV like, you know, 25 hours a day, because there's so much.
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, we were like latchkey kids. I mean, our parents, it wasn't like, you know, I mean, I think in the 70s, that's kind of a popular term, latchkey kid. I think when both parents worked, or maybe your parents had divorced or something. My parents are still together, but they both worked. So, you know, we would wear a key, you know, on a necklace around your neck, and that would be because you would come home to an empty house at 3 o'clock after school, and except for, you know, you still had a babysitter, the television, and you know, and back then, you know, we didn't, we had fewer options of viewing. And I guess, like, you would say maybe, like, nowadays there's so much more variety in programming that kids can just switch the channel when the topics get too adult, and they can, but you know, whatever, there's so much stuff is so adult now too. Comedy is so raunchy. So it's kind of hard to compare the two experiences. I have a 10-year-old son now, so I'm always thinking like how his experience is different than mine. But the thing that I don't know. I just always think about how I would watch the same stuff my parents were watching all the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's probably questionable, but there were no other choices. But the real question was, yeah, we ingested tons of television programming. It was really kind of, you know, and my parents weren't hippies. They didn't have like concepts like screen time and things like that. There was no one was considering, you know, if this exposure to this programming or imagery, you know, over prolonged time, like what kind of effect does it have on someone? And so I think that's one thing particularly interesting about our earlier, like the first 10 years, is really just about us regurgitating all that information back onto people.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's what happens when you have 25 hours of TV a day.
Yeah. So were they, I mean, did they have a record player in their house? Did they own records that they exposed you to, or what, did it all come organically?
My dad did have an interest in music, but he wasn't like, you know, he wasn't a rabid music fan. But he, in fact, I was just talking to him recently, and he even had an interest in jazz, which I was surprised to know. And I remember he did have a reel-to-reel machine, and he had his collection. He had some Simon and Garfunkel. He had some Cat Stevens, Waylon Jennings, kind of, you know, like not your average 70s collection, but it was all still pretty well-known stuff. Mm. And then, but the real connection, the hardcore connection for Jeff and I getting so into music in terms of family and being influential is that my dad is the oldest of 8 siblings, I think, 7 or 8. Some are deceased now. And so his youngest brother was 20 years younger than him, and which made him more like an older brother to me and Jeff. He was like 9 years older than Jeff, and he was into music, and he would give us stuff. Like we got Ziggy Stardust on 8-track the year it came out because my uncle had it, and we thought it looked cool, and we borrowed it, and then never gave it back. And then also, my dad had younger sisters, and one of them just happened to, she intersected with being 16 years old in 1964, and she was a huge Beatle fanatic. So when the Beatles came to America, they did their 3 tours, and she managed to bring Jeff to the last Beatles tour when he was 3 years old.
Oh, wow.
So Jeff saw the Beatles in San Diego. Jeff kind of remembers that. He remembered all the hoopla, remembered a lot of screaming, and apparently he slept through the concert. But he has memories of it. But, you know, but his point is that, like, my earliest memories are of things like, you know, Meet the Beatles. And, Sgt. Pepper came out a few months before I was born in 1967. So, you know, like, all that stuff was still, like, I vaguely remember, like, learning that the Beatles had broken up. Like, that was breaking news. Those are amongst my first memories. And then just to continue a little bit further on your very simple question with my complicated answer, but is that, you know, I mostly credit Jeff, just his interpretation of the world he was in, the landscape, surveying the landscape that he was in, to the unique kind of sophisticated taste that I had at such a young age. You know, Jeff was bringing home records. You go to the record store, and he brought home, you know, Hunky Dory when he was, he must have been like 9 years old or something, 10 years old. He brought home so many great records, and he was so obsessed with it. You know, it's like basically, you know, like right now we're all in quarantine and it's uncertain times, and people are, I read a lot of people on social media talking about comfort music, you know, like you have comfort food when you're in a dreary place. Or if you're in an anxious place, you might listen to comfort music. And, it's all that music it's all the music I grew up with. It's still my favorite music. It's still the stuff I go to soothe me or to also accentuate a good time. And history is, you know, the way history views most of the, pretty much all of it is that it's a bit of a golden era for rock and roll, you know, the time that I was coming up, you know, with this interesting time of technology intersecting with creativity. And I was lucky to intersect with that moment.
So your brother, who's 3 years older than you, if I've got the story sort of right, it's sort of his idea. Let's start a band and you'll be the bass player. And
I would say that Jeff groomed me. I would say everything was his brainchild and he groomed me. That's what I would say.
You're in the cult of Jeff. But how did it go from was it just, you know, the attitude of like, you could have started a band that would have, you know, this was 1978 or 79 or something. You could have started a band like so many other sounds that were happening then. What drew you guys to this punk thing? Why not some much more mellow poppy thing?
We liked, you know, mellowy poppy things from the early 70s, like Cat Stevens and and things like that. And or the Partridge Family, which I was just listening to on my walk like 10 minutes ago. And back to that comfort music. But you know, one of the big things that sort of signaled an entrance point for us to start playing guitars and was The Runaways. The Runaways really kind of exposed us to this idea of, look, if you want to do it, you should just do it. Do it now. And it wasn't just that they were girls doing it. It was that they were really young. And I mean, they're a little bit older than me. But, you know, when I was, I guess in 1976 is when their first album came out. And 1976, like, my favorite records were the big arena rock records like Aerosmith Rocks and Kiss Alive and Destroyer. And then the Runaways come along, and they're in the same magazines, and they've got the same set of rock and roll points of reference, but they're 16-year-old women, and they're fucking, you know, just great. And you know, I know that part of their story is that they had to weather a lot of snobbery from male musicians, and just a lot of skepticism in general, you know, sexism. But, you know, just being a little kid in the suburbs, reading about them in Circus Magazine or, you know, Cream, I didn't really know about what, you know, what their trials were. I just was super inspired by them. And so it was a combination of the Runaways and the Ramones. You know, the other thing was that, you know, I mean, Led Zeppelin, for instance, I saw Led Zeppelin when I was 9 years old. I was really lucky. Once again, Jeff exposing me to all sorts of things. And we went to a Zeppelin concert. Their last tour of the States was their Presence tour. And I love Led Zeppelin, but, you know, there, in terms of, it didn't inspire you to, for me at least, it didn't really inspire me to pick up a guitar. That was like wizardry. It was mastery. it was, you really needed a manual, and you needed like a guide, and and you're going to need all sorts of discipline or innate talent. And you know, the whole thing was just totally discouraging. And yeah. So we didn't really pursue it, but the first Ramones album, we were able to kind of cobble together, like learn some of those tunes. And they were just, you know, I saw them early on Don Kirshner's rock concert. And it was like, what is that shape he's doing with his hand, the bar chord, you know? And you learn the bar chord, and suddenly you could just slide it up and down the neck. And next thing you know, you're playing Blitzkrieg Bop. And so that was super inspiring. And then we just kind of realized right around that time we got guitars, we learned the first Ramones album, and then we're like, oh, well, we should just make our own songs. It's actually, in some ways, easier just to make your own songs.
Yeah.
You know, they were rudimentary, but it's that first batch of songs that we're reissuing soon on the first Red Cross EP, and I think they have a certain appeal, and they're kind of like, I was thinking about recently, in some ways that record is kind of like a gateway record into underground music.
Oh yeah.
It's for people, I think, you know,
it's fantastic. Cool. And the songs are, I think the songs really hold up. You mentioned it, but yeah, Merge is re-releasing it June 26th with some live tracks and I think demos and stuff like that. 40th yeah. anniversary. There's some great pictures on the Merge website of you. You were 11 when you started playing, and I think 13 when you recorded that. And you just look like a little kid playing the bass, but there's this sort of like totally punk look on your faces in some of the pictures. And it's just amazing.
Yeah, so I was going for it. Yeah, but technically I was 12 when I recorded it. I might have been 13 when it came out, and I think I was still 12. I don't know, but yeah.
What did your father, yeah. the precision welder, what did he think about this?
Oh, he thinks it's cool now, you know.
Back then, did he want to kill you, or, you know?
Oh, no. I think we're probably a little baffling to my parents, but I will say, you know, to their credit, they recognized the value that we were passionate about something. So even if it wasn't something that they necessarily felt that they had any way to give us a leg up on, it, you know, it might have been a world that was foreign to them. They recognized that it was that we seem to have some kind of calling or whatever, you know, however you describe that, yeah. that is rare. And so they were supportive. And,
yeah, that's good parenting.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's remarkably, you know, kind of progressive of them. And I'm grateful for that, yeah.
Yeah, so first album comes out in 1982, I think. And one of the things I love about it is the average song length is like a minute and 17 seconds, probably. You guys put out an EP of covers. You guys then put out Neurotica, 1987, produced by Tommy Ramone. So the sort of circle sort of comes around. Tell me about working with him and sort of that. You know, that you're still so young and everything, but tell me about him as a producer.
Well, he was really nice, you know, it was cool to, you know, I mean, I think for us, I think the prospect of like working with like the quote unquote producer was probably a bit of an intimidating prospect. And you're also always worried that someone's going to try to make you change or do something you don't feel comfortable about. And, you know, just because of all the mythology that revolved around music production, any creative endeavor, and you know what is a music producer? It's so vague, or it's so all encompassing. It can be many different things. It all depends on the artist and the producer. And and we had a pretty clear cut ideas of what we were trying to do. So it was really like, for us, you know, we were just kind of, we had to come up with a list of people we wanted to work with. And although that's one thing that's different about the newer generations and the older generations, I think when vinyl records were more popular, you know, there was a whole thing around reading the liner notes. You would listen to your record, you'd listen to the full album while you're like looking at the lyrics or the liner notes, whatever information, textual information that the artist was willing to let you in on what was going on was really exciting, and it was mystifying. You wanted to know as much about that world as possible. So I took an interest in like who worked on records. And but you know, like this is 1987, so it's a weird time in music. I guess it would have been in the early 2000s is when the 80s revival really kind of started kicking in. It seems like that's the 20-year cycle, and I would notice young artists suddenly wearing clothes that look like, you know, they dug out of El DeBarge's, you know, yard sale. And then just like, isn't this amazing? I remember I was working with an artist, I was recording an artist, and he started referencing Paul Simon's Graceland album, and he was serious about it. And I'm sure it's a fine record, but I mean, at the time, I'm just like, wait, you're telling me that that's a sound that you want? And you know, I just never thought that the 80s was a great time for, because it was also this weird moment where like, that's why I feel like the early 70s, late 60s was just this great moment where artistry and where technology were at, where they intersected, was this really great moment where analog technology had finally gotten to its like zenith, you know, its apex. And suddenly musicians had 24 tracks or 16 tracks to record with. But by the 80s, it just, people were looking, they're still trying to get something new out of this stuff, and they just kind of leaned on the reverb too much, or they leaned on the drum machine too much, or whatever, you know? And I get it, they're all attempts at making something new, and I get why that's important to, you know, you gotta challenge yourself, and you know, I don't know, there's all those metaphors. There's the shark that has to keep swimming, or that's the only way water, oxygen goes into its gills. If it doesn't keep moving, then it dies. And I guess that's kind of like the era of progress, and it affects, you know, the creative realm as well. But at times, I just think the 80s was a moment when, and, you know, maybe this makes me sound old and whatever, but and too much of a purist. But I mean, it's still much of that music. I can really love the music, but I'm constantly finding myself overlooking the production. So that's when we were teenagers, or late teenagers, early 20s, and being given the opportunity to go into a studio and make records. So we were very skeptical about the process of working with anybody that was going to try to make us sound current. So it was nice to know that Tommy Ramone was out there making records at the time. And he had just made he had just worked with the Ramones, who he was no longer playing in the band, but they had just made a record that he had produced or co-produced called Too Tough to Die. And it was a really like, it felt like it was this real return to form album. It was a great album. And so when we were given that opportunity, it just so happens that was probably my favorite new record of that 1-2 year span, from 85 to 87 or whatever. And so, you know, we asked, and he had just also made the Replacements album, Tim. So we knew those guys a little bit, and, you know, we asked them, you know, how did that go? And, you know, whatever. So we got the word that Tommy was cool, and that was going to be, and he was open to it. He was down to it. He was down to come to LA and work with us. And, you know, and we just had lots of questions about, you know, the Ramones, early Ramones.
Let me remind folks that Steve McDonald of the band Red Cross is our guest on the program today.
That's me.
That's you.
I've got long-winded answers. So if you're wondering, who is this guy rambling with that nasally SoCal drawl? It's the dude from Red Cross.
Let's talk about the Red Cross's live show. You guys sort of always seem to go for it. You embrace it. You eat it up. You love it. Is there anything I need to know other than you'd love it, and we can see that?
Well, yeah, we're hams. We love it. well, you know, I mean, I think the other draw for playing music, I mean, probably the first draw for playing music was this fantasy about getting on stage and putting on a show. And I think that, you know, harkens back to, once again, the music that moment we intersected with in the early 70s, late 60s. You know, I mean, I loved Bowie, the theatricality of Bowie. Jeff saw Alice Cooper on the Welcome to My Nightmare tour. That's one of his earliest concerts. He saw Elton John on the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road tour. It was one of his first concerts. First concert I got to go to was Kiss on the First Alive, when they were still music for teenagers, before they had turned into like teeny boppers playing weird disco music. and those shows were such big spectacles, and there was such a fantasy being peddled that I bought 100%. And, you know, Jeff and I were we were posing in the mirror with broomsticks and singing into Coke cans long before we had learned to play our first D chord. So, you know, making records, I mean, that's one thing. I'm sure it's a question on your list at some point, probably like 40 years. Why is there only 8 albums? You know, we weren't the most prolific band. And I think that, you know, the learning to make records is another art form into itself. I think our first interest was the art form of performance.
Mm.
And we really wanted to get up there and move around and express ourselves that way. And writing songs, making records were cool, but they were, you know, scary and intimidating, and you're under a horrible microscope, and you had to hear the results back, and you had to live with your failures as much as your successes with records, like just creatively speaking, and, you know, the making of, executing. And live was just this really exciting thing to us. There's just such a draw to it. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't know what that is telling of who we are. I don't know if that means if our parents loved us in a weird, wrong way or something, that we needed the attention so bad. But I would definitely say that we were interested in creating some kind of fantasy, you know, but I think it's one that's about joy, and it's one of about, it's all positive, you know, and, I mean, it's one of the things that makes me feel like I'm not just that much of a black hole, vacuous black hole of, you know, of me, because I think it does bring joy to people, put smiles on people's faces, and when we travel around and do that stuff. And And that's, you know, especially nowadays.
I've seen you guys live a million times and always, always, always a great show. So Third Eye comes out, I think 1990, the song Annie's Gone. To me, total number one hit single. I'm not sure what happened there. They didn't give the package of money to the right DJs or something, but that song, total number one hit. Phase Shifter, 1993, Show World, 1997, and then there's 15 years until Researching the Blues, 2012. Why? What happened? What's the reason?
So after Show World, in 97, I'm turning 30, 31, 98, and so 78 is when we first picked up our guitars and wrote songs. So it was really that was the 20 year anniversary. And I think I had just gotten really concerned to be you know how you always kind of, at the top of a new decade for yourself, you kind of find yourself, I mean, at least I'm someone that does that. I think it's a common phenomena to start taking inventory of your life and going the course that you're on. And the course that I was on was one that I had, my life course, my career course, I had chosen it, or as I said earlier, my brother kind of groomed me for it, but I had chosen it at the age of 11. So I kind of started to feel like I was maybe being a little, just maybe a tad irresponsible. You know, and we had been on two major labels. And, you know, in the industry, it's the idea of I never really knew that there was a sort of middle ground, this idea of just having a nice middle class income as a working musician. I thought it was more your goal was you're an underground musician and then you get onto a major label and then you're either have breakthrough to the mainstream and you become wealthy or you're flipping burgers somewhere. I didn't really know there was any other in between world. And so we had made two records for a major in the 90s. We made Show World and for one particular label. And I knew that Show World and Phase Shifter, and we weren't going to be making another record for them. They weren't asking us to. So we were getting dropped from another label. So it just meant okay, so no one in the major label world is going to have any interest in us now. We're double stigmatized now. We've been dropped from Atlantic. We've been dropped from Polygram now. And so that's done. Where do you go from there? And I didn't know the internet existed then, but it was dial up. I didn't have the vision that I was soon, you know, in a lot of ways that the gatekeepers, the system in which you're operating in now is going to be changing radically in the next decade or two. I didn't know that. And I just started to feel anxious. I thought I needed to see what other options there were in the world. So we went into hiatus for about 9 years. I went to school for about 3 years, but of course I wasn't studying business. I was studying music. But I think I thought more I've produced a few records. Maybe I should go figure out more about the language, the anatomy of music, so you can speak a little bit more sophisticatedly about it, depending on, you give yourself more options of what kind of musicians you might be able to work with as a producer and stuff like that. So I did that for a while, and then I found myself also playing in other people's projects, as a side guy for bigger bands. I played with Beck at some point. I played with Sparks for a while, and I just did that stuff for about 8-9 years. Produced some records. So we had been on hiatus for about 8-9 years, and in 2006, I think it was actually, some friends asked us to do a show. So in 2006, we did our first show. It was a Neurotica lineup at the Don't Knock the Rock Festival. And then there was some a Spanish promoter had been trying to get us over there for years at that point, really persistent, and found us through email, through our website. We always had redcross.com, thanks to John Kropp, our great webmaster. And we went and played this big festival in Spain, and they loved us. And we were kind of touted as you know, the best, you know, the best band at the Azcana Rock Festival and whatever. So Spain has a very interesting rock and roll purist community. Those kind of things all came together and gave us a big shot in the arm and inspired us to, you know, do Red Cross again. Now, Researching the Blues didn't come for another four more years. We actually started the record in 2008, but we didn't release it until 2012 because we made it ourselves. We had to find the time to make it in between our regular lives. And then also I had to learn how to mix. I had to learn how to take on the technical aspects of finishing a record. I had already been a producer, but I hadn't really been an engineer. So I had to learn how to do all the engineering and how to finish the record. And, you know, I tried to hire other people to do it, but we had very limited funds doing it ourselves. But I just never liked the results. And then I eventually figured out how to do it myself. And then we found a record label. And luckily, Merge was, you know, like our first choice, and they were totally down to do it. And we felt really lucky. It's really hard to make a record in, like, your own little vacuum without knowing if anybody wants to put it out or if anybody cares or anything like that. So was really, really grateful for that.
Yeah. So there's a 40th anniversary re-release of the EP with bonus tracks coming out on Merge, and Third Man is re-releasing some of the older stuff, I think, on vinyl. And that brings us to Beyond the Door, which is just came out a few months ago. And There's No One Like You, a number one hit, Stephen. That song, again, just blew my mind. And the first time I heard it, I was like, what the hell is this? What is this guy talking about? And then I mean, is it simply a song to your son?
Yeah. Yeah, my little half-Jewish son. Or he's full Jew, and he wants to tell me that he wants to remind me that I'm not. I think that's a part where people are like, wait, what did he just say? He said something about Jew? What is that? Yeah, it's the trials of a blended family, I suppose. But Anna helped me write the lyrics too. I remember I tried to write them all by myself, and I couldn't. I got stuck, and she is so gifted with words. And I didn't want to put the pressure on her. It wasn't as much of me being like a baby about it's all mine. It was more like I was just trying not to put pressure on her. And anyways, Anna, so my wife Anna Warnker. Some of you, the audience, might know her as the songwriter, lead singer for the band That Dog. Or some people just might know her as Anna Warnker, extraordinaire musician talent. She scores film and TV now too. But at any rate, she's a very gifted lyricist, and so I just knew that I wanted that song to be about Alfie, and I knew that's the name of our son, Alfie, and I knew that, and I had that lyric: "There's no one like you." And that's how that went. And so, and the funny thing is, and I had all these grand ideas, but I didn't know how to get it out of me. And she's really good at collaborating, especially with songs. She's done it many times now. And I'm super, when it comes to words, I feel all, you know, knotted up inside, and it's hard for me to get them out in the way I want them. And I thought that Anna, the way she got it, the way she delivered it, I think of it more, it was less of a writing. It was less of a collaboration. It was more of a delivery. I think of her as like a song midwife. If it turned out the song was Breach, she was going to have to cut me open. She could have done that, and all these things. But yeah, it happened, and yeah, it went quickly. And thank you for saying that, because I don't know.
It's a great song, and the recording of the song, helps deliver it as well. You know, it's a perfect expression of the idea of the song. So,
thank you.
Yeah, you guys have a ton of gigs scheduled all around the world. I mean, who knows if those will happen? I hope they do, because You know, I think I know that I'm just missing loud music. You know, I want to hear some loud music.
Well, we also wanted to promote the new album still. It's just crazy because we put the new album out. We put out Beyond the Door in August of 2019, and we immediately went on tour, but we toured as a support act for the other band that I'm in, the Melvins, which is great, and it was really cool. We did 10 weeks in the States, but we'd always known that it was like, okay, so, but then in 2020, we're going to hit the road and do a bunch of headlining shows, and we're really going to, you know, and it's all, that's kind of got, you know, it's all been turned into this mucky muck.
Well,
and, you know, putting out all these old records, like, it's something I've been, like, slowly cobbling together for years, and, you know, so we don't know, but hopefully, because we had a U.S. tour planned for May, June, and now we probably won't be doing any of those. But, yeah, it's a drag. We definitely won't be doing the May, June, but it doesn't look like we're even able to reschedule anything in the U.S.
Yeah, well, yeah. We'll all just cross our fingers and check the Red Cross website, I guess, for
updates. Tell me, so as a fan, so you said you're really missing going to live music. How do you feel about do you think that when they start letting people do that, I mean, do you think you're just going to go for it? Like, how was it going to change your experience? I'm very curious, like, how this COVID pandemic experience is going to affect, you know, the fans.
I think until there's a vaccine and lots of testing, that no one's going anywhere, you know? Safely.
So even if there's treatments but no vaccine, you don't know if you'd even go.
I don't want to die.
No, I know. And I don't want you to jeopardize anyone in your family either. Yeah. You know, I don't want to jeopardize anyone. Believe me, I've been thinking about it. I mean, like, I'm in, you know, they kept talking about, you know, no large gatherings. I'm like, I've never put it that way, but that's the business I'm in, creating large gatherings. The larger, the better. And you know, so it's also like, whoa, this is very different.
Right. It gives Stay Away from Downtown a whole new meaning. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's hear There's No One Like You, this number one hit record. And Steve McDowell from Red Cross, thank you for joining us this morning. And I loved hearing the story. And, you know, you guys are such, like, particular human beings. I'm always curious how you wound up who you are.
Oh, well, hopefully I've shed some light on that.